Sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you'll hear the second and final part of an interview with Henry Lowendorf of the Greater New Haven Peace Council. Henry has been a peace activist since the 1960s U.S. war on Vietnam. He's a co-chair of the Greater New Haven Peace Council and is a member of the Executive Committee of the U.S. Peace Council and a representative to the World Peace Council, an NGO of the United Nations. The Peace Council is a multiracial, anti-imperialist organization committed to peace, economic and social justice, and to international solidarity with the peoples of the world. In addition to many local and statewide efforts, Henry co-organized a number of recent international conferences. In New York in 2010, calling for the abolition of nuclear weapons. In Chicago in 2012, calling for the dissolution of NATO. In Haifa and Ramallah, Israel and the West Bank, in 2013, calling for a zone free of WMD in the Middle East. He is a founding member of the New Haven chapter of Jewish Voices for Peace. Henry has a PhD in biology from Case Western Reserve University. In 2007, he retired from his position as associate director of Yale University's Office of Cooperative Research, responsible for handling all the university's inventions, patents, and invention licenses to focus on promoting peace and justice. Henry Lowendorf recently visited Syria with a peace delegation. So let's continue with the interview about what he learned during that trip.
If you asked the question, there was certainly gratitude toward the Russians.
And the Russians then, I mean, I think our media does a great job of making the Russians look horrible. The propaganda about Russia is so outrageous here.
Yeah, it's over the top, and yet that's what we hear. We talk about Putinizing. I've been Putinized because I oppose the demonization of Putin. It's not whether I like Putin or not. That's irrelevant. It's whether the Russian people want him to be the president or not. That's what's relevant.
Right.
The United States decided that Putin had to go because he obviously is a thorn in their side or more in the establishment side. But same thing happened in Ukraine. The United States decided that the elected government of Ukraine, the elected president of Ukraine, Yanukovych, had to go. And so Victoria Nuland in the State Department was caught on the phone by some clever hacker saying, we got to overthrow this government and we have Yatsenyuk, he's our guy. And she swore at the Europeans because they had someone else they wanted to put in. But it was Yats who got put in once the elected government of Ukraine had been overthrown. Same kind of thing.
Right.
Demonization. This guy is corrupt, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. But it isn't up to the United States to overthrow him.
And he might not even be that corrupt. You know, who knows, based on the media.
Well, right. Yeah. Well, it wouldn't surprise me, but that's a separate, we can debate that, we can look at, you know, we can get experts to talk about that, but it's not our business to decide other people's governments. This is the problem. We have people in the peace movement around the country and in Connecticut who think that it is the United States' responsibility to overthrow other governments. Yeah. It is our responsibility. They may not say it, but they act it. They walk the walk because they don't oppose it. And someone who doesn't pay any attention to war and peace issues in the United States, someone doesn't pay attention to political issues, okay, you don't care. You don't know about it. But these are peace people. To sit on the fence as a peace person is reprehensible. And what it means is a peace person that you end up supporting, you end up allowing the government of the United States to run rampant over the world. And in fact, what you do is you allow, you start attacking other people in the peace movement and say, we have, when I say the United States, the main thing, the first thing that has to happen is the United States has to stop creating harm in Syria. Get out of Syria, let the Syrians do their thing. We will then support the people of Syria. We support the people of Syria right now. The first thing is that we support the people of Syria by getting the United States out of there and letting them make their own decisions. And then we support the people of Syria in their decision about how they want to be governed. So it's step one, step two.
And you're getting opposition from within the peace movement. That's really sad. Let me ask you, Henry, and I don't know if you will have the answer to this or not, but Turkey now, after this a coup in Turkey with Erdogan, and it looks like the United States was behind that, and I see now that the Turks and the Russians are meeting and collaborating more. Do you see a shift in that whole scenario in Syria?
I know that there's been some talk of that, and the Turks and the Iranians have gotten together, that they're making some gestures toward peace and toward solving this problem. I think it's hopeful. Let's keep in mind that there's a very strong magnet for Turkey to Europe and to the United States, and that's NATO. And that's Turkey's desire to become a member of the European Union. So those are very strong magnets. And Erdogan, I did an interview with a Turkish peace person, and then I've since done some reading on it. Erdogan really wanted to create a new Ottoman Empire. He and Assad were friends, but he decided, no, I want a bigger Turkey. I want a greater Turkey, and that's going to include parts of Syria. And so he then moved with the United States to overthrow Assad. Now he seems to be moving in the reverse direction, and we will see how serious that is and how real that is if he cuts off and the Turkish government cuts off the flow of weapons, monies, strategic materials, and mercenaries into Syria. If he cuts off that flow, that will dry up the war very quickly. You know, even if he decided to do it right now, it's going to take him. He has to turn around all of the spigots that have been moving in one direction. And we'll see. There's so many complicating factors, especially in the Middle East, that I'm very cautious. I'm slightly optimistic that there's movement in the right direction. He's talking to the Russians, he's talking to the Iranians, and I hope he's going to talk to the Syrians and reestablish a normal relationship, which is not to overthrow the government.
Since the taping of this show in late August, it now appears that the attempted coup in Turkey that Erdogan blamed on the U.S. was another false flag event. The Turkish leader Erdogan used the attempted coup to rid his government and military of anyone opposing his aggressive policies concerning Syria. And without their countering influence, he recently invaded Syria and continues to work with the U.S. And now back to the interview. Now, I want to ask you, because I listened to an interview you did, I think it was with some Syrian TV station. I know in Libya they had free health care and free university, lots of free things for the people that we don't have here in America. And I'm just wondering, I think you mentioned that Syria had the same thing. They had free higher education, free health care, et cetera. Could you speak to that at all?
Yes. So many people also told us this. The education from preschool through graduate school, not just the high school, not just the college, but through graduate school, is paid for by the Syrian government. There are apparently some small fees, and some of the opposition parties want to remove those. They feel that for poor families, even these small fees are too expensive. But essentially, it's free. I mean, imagine a student going to medical school in the United States, which may cost $100,000 or $150,000 a year, paying only $50 a year.
Yeah.
That's sort of where the Syrians are. Yes, so healthcare is free. Education is free. We were told that, and then this gets to one of the things that I should have been aware of, but wasn't, and that is the United States in 2011 instituted sanctions against Syria, the same kind of thing that they did with Iran, what they did in the 90s with Iraq, what they've done with Cuba and still doing with Cuba, these sanctions to try to cut off and destroy the economy. And the theory is that once you really destroy the economy, the people rise up and overthrow the government and welcome the United States with candy and flowers. Didn't happen. But still, the sanctions are there. And we were told they can't get medicines, they can't get infant formula, they can't get machine parts for factories and industry because of these sanctions. And various of the organizational people urged us to do something about the sanctions. So the first thing we can do, obviously, and probably the most important thing that we have the power to do, is to educate our own neighbors that these sanctions are there. And then it's not going to change the government's role. It's not going to overthrow Assad. What the sanctions are doing is making life very, very difficult for the Syrians. their standard of living, and obviously the cost of the war is an enormous burden. For the United States, it's peanuts. Until we send 100,000 troops, then it's no longer insignificant. But this is all being done mostly covertly, and the Saudis and the Qataris are paying for it. For the United States, it's peanuts. But for the Syrians, it's hugely costly. Right. They can't get cancer meds. And still, if you have cancer and there are some meds, you get them free. I mean, this was told us by the health minister. It was told us by others as well.
Now, you said you also met with Assad. What was that like?
Yes, so we did. Actually, we had an hour and three quarters with Assad, an amazing amount of time. He welcomed us. Now, keep in mind, and this is important, I want to be transparent about this. It took us about a year of negotiations with the Syrian ambassador to the UN, Dr. Jafari, to get this delegation to go to Syria. It took a long time.
Mm.
It wasn't confrontational negotiations at all. It was very supportive because we're saying to him, look, our primary goal here is to get the peace movement off of dead center, off out of its paralysis, to stop the U.S. war on Syria. That's our role. That's what our goal is. And we want to be able to talk to anybody we decide to talk to, and we also want to have meetings with high-level government officials. So he made the arrangements for us, the ambassador to the U.N., and we therefore got to speak with high-level ministers, but we also got to speak with NGOs. We spoke with people who were active on the front lines of trying to get supplies, food and water, into the areas that the terrorists control. And we heard about the difficulties of that. We heard about from the people who are on the front lines of trying to reach out to the people who are besieged by the terrorists, trying to get the U.N., to play a positive role. Much of what we heard about the UN was not positive. We spoke to the leaders of the student union. We spoke with the president of Damascus University, which has accepted students from Aleppo University because they fled Aleppo, and the Syrians don't want to have a gap in their education. And so Damascus University accepted all of these students. And it had to have, you know, it had raised its budget to do that, and the government agreed. So we spoke with the Chamber of Industry, which would presumably be our Chamber of Commerce. And many CEOs and owners of companies were at this meeting. And they told us story after story of what has happened, how the terrorists have taken over their factories, and how they've responded, which is, it's very impressive because they understand also what happens to them if the terrorists win. They understand what happens to them. So we talked, as I said, we talked with faith leaders. We talked with a lot of different organizations. And we went to one of the schools. It's a school that's called the Orphans of Martyrs School. These are children, and this was a girls' school. There was a boys' school separate. We went to the girls' school. These are girls and young women whose parent or parents have been killed in the war.
Mm.
From whatever side, no matter what side the parent was on, they're the orphans, and they're Syrians, so they're taken in, and they get free room and board, and they get help, extra points in getting into the university. And for some of them, they have no families at all.
Mm.
So after the school year, they stay at this school. They're taken care of. So we got to go there. We saw a very interesting institution which was training women, mostly young women, to sew, who had no background in no marketable skill. And they also were widows and had lost the bread earner in the family, and some of them were illiterate because they came from very conservative communities that didn't believe in universal education, even though it's available. So they were getting literacy, and they had child care for the families. Anyway, very interesting things that the Syrians are doing on a humanitarian level, of course, under very difficult conditions.
How long were you there for?
We were there for 5 days and 6 nights, and not a long time. And let me tell you, I do not know everything about Syria after being there in 5 days. I don't claim to be, and I'm not speaking for the Syrian people. I'm just saying to you, I'm telling you what we saw and heard.
Yeah, I really think that's great, and thank you so much for putting the effort and the idea to go do that and taking a risk. I think that's a bit of a risk also to be going to a country that's at war. So appreciate your efforts there.
Thank you.
Is there anything that we haven't talked about, Henry, that you want to share?
Well, there are a lot of details, but I think we've covered the main points of what I'm concerned about and what I think that the Syrians are concerned about from what we saw and heard. But let me just share in some of the details, because there's an organization called the Syrian Trust for Development. And I had no idea when I saw this on our agenda. I had no idea what it was or what they did. And this is the first thing that we learned about this organization was the sewing classes. And this is only one thing that the organization, it's an NGO. It isn't a government organization.
Mm-hmm.
It's non-government. They train women in sewing. And one of the people who took us around was actually an industrialist who had a sewing factory. And he comes in because he knows the whole trade and he knows the skills. And so he is a leader in, they have industrial sewing machines. Once they graduate, they can do advanced sewing, or if they want to get a job, they're helped to get a job, or if they want to start a little business, they're helped in that way, too. And within the confines of this one set of buildings, they had child care, the kids were being taught English, they had literacy classes. We talked to the women. We said, well, it's nice to hear from the people who run this joint, this place, but we would really like to talk to the women, and so they talked to us. I was actually impressed at how vocal they were about what they were doing. Not, it wasn't political in the sense of, you know, they weren't talking about Assad or the war or anything like that. They were just talking about their own lives. And one woman talked about how she had given up her education to help her family, and then she'd gotten married and had kids, and she urged her kids to get an education, but she was illiterate. And so she was, her kids had gotten an education. She said, now it's time for me. She was one of the older people. It was very moving. It was very moving. And, you know, the same organization, we met with them in another location, the same organization, they have a different mission, which is to get food and water and medical supplies to the besieged areas. And there were two villages, I don't have the names in the top of my head, two villages that are under the control of the mercenary terrorists. And we asked to speak to a young man that they mentioned, they talked about, they brought him in afterwards, and we spoke with him, a young man whose family was in one of the besieged villages, but he had gotten out, and he was working with this NGO. He would go to the village to negotiate with the terrorists to get food and medicines and stuff in to the village. He said, you know, it's very dangerous. It's very dangerous because, of course, they could just shoot him. And he was very diffident. He was somewhat shy. But he just told us the stories. And one of the things he told us, and I mentioned the UN, I don't know if this is consistent or inconsistent, but the UN relief has been very, let us say, not above board. Often the foods that are sent in are overdue dates. Often the foods that are sent in to places that don't have significant amounts of water require cooking, or don't have fuel require cooking, or they send in stuff that's just inappropriate. And also, much of the stuff that the UN sends in is appropriated by the terrorists, put in warehouses, and then they either sell it at high prices to the residents, or they send it around to some of the other, you know, terrorist organizations. So a lot of the stuff from the UN gets misappropriated, and it is not going to where it needs to go. And that's something that, of course, these folks are trying, you know, they have to negotiate with the UN, too. So those were some of the stories that we heard. We also heard stories about how this so-called revolution started.
Well, I'd really like to hear that.
So the stories are it started not in the center of the country, but started on the periphery. And that makes sense if it's being started and mobilized by people from other countries, from mercenaries from outside the country. One of the places was Daraa, which is on the Jordanian border. And we were told a story, and we were told this by several different people, including the leader of the opposition, the nonviolent opposition party. His name is Ali Haidar. And he said, we had demonstrations in Daraa. We were demonstrating against the government. But very quickly, guns appeared. Very quickly, guns appeared, not among our supporters, but people that we didn't know. And shooting occurred, and the first people who got shot were the police, and then people who were demonstrating got shot. Mm. Now, in the United States, the propaganda is that the government was shooting the demonstrators. But what we got from the Syrians was, that's not the way it started. We also heard from one of the leaders of the student union whose family is in Daraa, and he says he was there. And he said there were people who all of a sudden had lots of dollars. These are people who had never a job in their life. And all of a sudden they had lots of dollars and they had guns. And where does this stuff come from? Well, the guns came through Jordan and they came presumably via the CIA. And the dollars came from Saudi Arabia. So people were Syrians. They were Syrians. He called them thieves and smugglers. And being on the border, okay, smuggling goes on. We were also told that it was true in Malula, which is another interesting story, where Aramaic is still spoken, the language of Jesus is still spoken north of Damascus in a village, and there's a shrine there that got vandalized and partially destroyed by the terrorists. But getting back to, there are Syrians who have joined the mercenaries, and they're getting well paid. And I don't know that all of them, I can't say that, I don't know that. But some of them anyway, and the initial ones, are people who did not have jobs and who were thieves and were smugglers, according to what we heard.
And I had read that a lot of the training of some of the ISIS was done by the CIA in Jordan. So it's interesting that this would happen on the border with Jordan.
Right. And, of course, you can find it, although it doesn't constantly get repeated. The U.S. admits to spending $500 million training fighters for the Free Syrian Army. That is, the mercenaries that the U.S. is hiring. But the U.S. has spent $500 million. With that $500 million, they got under 100 people, and then they ended up with maybe a dozen fighters, and all of the fighters went over to the extremists. So $500 million, that's a lot of money. That'll buy a lot. That went down the tubes, and you can imagine, I can imagine, how much more has been spent, both by the U.S. and the Saudis and the Qataris.
Right.
The other thing, which to me doesn't make any sense at all, and it is so absurd, the United States wanted the Saudis to train fighters to go into Syria to bring about democracy. Now, think about that for a moment.
Yeah, that's absurd.
Right? Saudi Arabia, one of the most tyrant dictatorships in the world, with a merciless reputation, does all of its own beheading, more than the ISIS, and it's training people to bring about democracy.
Yeah, that's absurd.
And yet, the United States admits to this stuff. I mean, and where's the media?
Well, you know, they count on most Americans to be too uninformed to know that, to know anything about that, or that like, sounds crazy.
Not to connect the dots.
And they keep it going with the propaganda. So we were in a tough situation because the whole media, a lot of the alternative media, too, is controlled. You know, they get a lot of foundation money and George Soros funding. And we're in a tough situation, and it's only the internet and maybe radio programs like mine and others that help get this out, and people with your message. And so tell us, Henry, where you want to go with this.
The major work for us right now is ahead of us, and that is to talk to people and to somehow break down this propaganda and to help people connect those dots, help people make the connection between this war and the previous wars, and cut through some of the propaganda with, you know, there are reports that decimate some of this propaganda. So we have to pull that together, and we have to be able to reach out to people. So we have to get that started. My co-leader in this, Jerry Condon from Veterans for Peace, lives on the West Coast, and he's already had a very important effect on the convention of Veterans for Peace. But we're going to be talking about this wherever we are, and we're going to try to, if we can, and this remains to be seen, if we can set up a tour and get some of us to go here or there and just tell people what we saw and what we understand so that we can break through this massive propaganda effort. So that's where we're going with it.
That's great.
You know, we sent out some news releases. There was an attack on us from the left in these times, and we're responding to that. So I will send that to you.
And is there a website people can go to get that information also?
That's a good question. I've been focused on other things, but the whole issue of media, it would be great to have a lot of people working on this, but we're small. We're trying to be catalytic here and get more and more people involved.
So would your website be uspeacecouncil.org?
Yes, okay. www.uspeacecouncil.org. Anyway, search for uspeacecouncil.org and you'll find it.
And you'll find it, yeah. Okay, so if people want more information about that. And Henry, unfortunately, we're running out of time. I really want to thank you for your efforts in this. More needs to be done around this. And I agree with you that the peace movement seems dead. There's nobody out there who cares at all, it seems, about all the wars that we're in and the innocent people we're hurting around the world. So I appreciate your efforts there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Cheryl. It's, as I say, we have to be able to talk to people and get people to start doubting and then act on those doubts.
Yes.
Start doubting the propaganda and start moving.
Yes. Well, good luck with your efforts, and we'll stay connected on it. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thanks. Okay.
And again, you were just listening to an interview with Henry Lowendorf of the Greater New Haven Peace Council, who recently returned from a trip to Syria. And now I need to tell you about a 9/11 event that has been canceled. The Connecticut 9/11 Truth Group invited author and journalist Christopher Boleyn to speak here on Thursday, September 8th, at the Unitarian Meeting House at 50 Bloomfield Avenue in Hartford. The Unitarian Meeting House has reported that they received several threats concerning the event and decided to cancel it. So if you were planning on coming out on Thursday, September 8th to hear Christopher Boleyn, the event has been canceled. This is not the first Boleyn event to be canceled due to threatening messages and phone calls to the venues where he was scheduled to speak. And many have caved in to the pressure. These censors are a very organized group. As I've said before, when someone doesn't want us to hear something, when they're censoring something, then that leads me to think that we need to hear that message all the more. So I encourage you, the listener, to check out Christopher Boleyn's presentations on YouTube. And his last name is spelled Boleyn, B-O-L-L-Y-N. And also check out his two companion books called Solving 9/11. There's somebody that doesn't want you to hear that message. Please do this so that the censors don't win. And I especially like the interview that Christopher Boleyn did with Sean Stone, and which you can find on YouTube by just looking for Sean Stone and Boleyn. And again, my apologies to anybody who really wanted to come and see that event. Hopefully we'll have him back again sometime in the future. And just a reminder that 9/11 Wake Up Call shows are archived at the website radioforall.net. And that's the digit 4, so radioforall.net. And once on the site, search under contributors for my name, Cheryl with a C, and the show should pop up in chronological order. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.